This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the Playlist Podcast, a weekly discussion of films and TV. I'm your host, Charles Barfield, managing editor of The Playlist. For this episode, I'm excited to share our recent interview with writer-director Tim Sutton. With his new film, Funny Face, arriving on April 2nd, filmmaker Tim Sutton talked to us recently about the film. Funny Face is a superhero film only Tim Sutton could make. The feature follows the story of a young guy named Saul who is upset with his life and the direction he thinks New York City is headed in. So what's a guy to do? Well, naturally, you grab a mask, team up with a Muslim girl who recently ran away from her family, and take on a greedy businessman. But that's Funny Face in the simplest of terms. What Sutton delivers is something much more complicated and much more unique. For those who have listened to the Playlist Podcast regularly, you've probably heard us discuss Tim Sutton before, and primarily when it comes to his previous film Donnybrook, which is one of my personal favorite films of the past few years. But Sutton is also a writer-director of a number of other features, including Memphis, Pavilion, and Dark Knight. Over the course of the interview, we talked to Sutton about Funny Face and its superhero origins, the complicated legacy of Donnybrook, and his upcoming Western that stars musician Machine Gun Kelly. I really think it's a fascinating discussion with a brutally honest independent filmmaker that refuses to be anything else other than true to himself and the stories he wants to tell, even if that leads to divisive films. But before I throw it to the interview, I got to tell you that the Playlist Podcast is part of the Playlist Podcast Network, which includes Be Real, The Fourth Wall, Deep Focus, and more. And if you want to find us, you can check your podcast app of choice, whether that's Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, Anchor, Stitcher, or anywhere else you find your favorite shows. Okay, so stick around and listen to Mike, Brian, and myself speak to filmmaker Tim Sutton about Funny Face, which again, it arrives on April 2nd. Enjoy. I'd like to welcome filmmaker Tim Sutton to the Playlist Podcast. Thanks for joining us to talk about your new film, Funny Face.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I got to admit, when the opportunity came for us to talk to you, my co-host made fun of me because they figured we'd just sit here for 30 minutes and talk about Donnybrook, and I'm going to try not to, but I would love to do that.
No, man, let's talk about Donnybrook. I'm happy to, trust me.
We will. We'll get to it, trust me. But let's talk about the film at hand here. Okay. When you talk about Funny Face, which is your new movie, you have to talk about the film in terms of the mask. That's kind of like the iconic imagery of this movie. It's a striking image. There's a grown man wearing a mask in public. It's strange, scary, a little sad even. What is it about a mask that makes you feel like it was important for this character, and why that mask?
Well, masks in general I've been kind of fascinated with for a number of years, just because, you know, Dark Knight was about, you know, the Batman mask in many ways for me. And Willis Earl Beale, who was the star of Memphis, as soon as Memphis kind of wrapped, he started wearing a mask like in his everyday, just a black mask. And he did that because he didn't want to be identified as a black person. He wanted to be identified as a person. And so the first thing you see with Willis now is the mask. So you don't see a black person, you see a person in a mask. And that it's a way of owning the identity that you want to present to the world rather than the identity that the world sees you. So, you know, I wanted to make a movie about New York. I wanted to make a movie about Brooklyn. I wanted to make a movie that one image was literally, you could put that mask on a poster and everybody would know without even a title what you were going for. And so the Funny Face mask, of course, is something that is rich in history. It's very symbolic of Brooklyn, but it's symbolic of Brooklyn's wild, weird, strange kind of freak show past. And that gave me the idea of what is that past up against right now? Well, it's up against money. It's up against power. It's up against the glossy change that started with Bloomberg. And so that's where it came from. But the mask essentially is is the power of the movie. It comes to you when you need it. It leaves you when you don't need it and when someone else needs it. And so I got this feeling, this idea of how this mask allows this person to be that kind of sad, weird, cool, you know, sad, weird, anonymous superhero, but in a Joey Ramone kind of way, in a punk rock kind of way.
And then there's another character in this who, spoiler alert, also wears the mask at some point.
Right.
Johnny Lee Miller, who we forever will refer to as Zero Cool from Hackers, because why not?
I think of him as Sick Boy from.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that is a much. Too. Yeah. We're dorks that think of. I think of Hackers, but yes, Train Spotting. No, way to go.
Plenty of people do. I think of him as Sick Boy, but
yeah,
for sure. But he plays a character just referred to as the developer in this.
Right.
And he's like a morally bankrupt, money-obsessed real estate magnate fraud that's trying to step out of his father's shadow and make a name for himself. And saying all that, some might draw comparisons to a certain well-known fella that used to live in New York, here in maybe the White House and now Florida. And
absolutely.
You know, was this film an active response to the climate that He Who Shall Not Be Named has brought about, or only in, not only in New York City, just across the nation?
You know, yes and no. I mean, I can't say it's like a purposeful, strategic response to Trumpism. As mm-hmm. a matter of fact, I always thought of the developer, and I told Johnny Lee Miller, the only direction I gave him was be Jared Kushner.
Wow.
I mean, that was really the only direction, and he knew what to do with that. So it's a response, but it's more of a response to how New York and how the country has changed, how, you know, money has always been, you know, obviously an important part of the game, but it started feeling after, you know, almost 25 years in New York that money was the only game in town, and that the New York that I love and that I'm sure you guys or other people like us love was disappearing. And disappearing in a way that felt not only crass, but heartbreaking. And I think that's happening, whatever, look at what Austin looks like now, you know, look at what San Francisco looks like now, look at what a lot of cities look like now. And you see it's money and it's power and the rest of us have to kind of suck it, you know? So that was really what the movie was about, that part of it, you know, was trying to make, trying to go to war a little bit, trying to go to war for the side that I think is right.
You mentioned war there, and this film could have easily devolved into like a dark, violent revenge thriller, but it stops short just when you think it could go over the edge. And this isn't the first time one of your films has gone this way. And do you mm-hmm. feel that kind of violence would have undercut the themes you were trying to deal with here?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, earlier drafts of the script had horrific violence at the end. Horrific violence, horrific. You know, I gotta say, one of the reasons I pulled back from that was because of Donnybrook. Because I feel like with Donnybrook, I took something dark and violent, and I really took it to the end of the road. As far as I'm concerned, I went as deep and as dark and as violent as I possibly could. And I came back thinking that's not necessarily A, my New York story, but B, guys like Saul don't get to the guys like the developer. They can rage and they can throw eggs and they can, you know, come close. But the bottom line is a guy like Saul's just looking for a friend. He's just looking for someone to care for him. He's looking for someone to care for. So all this pent up rage, all this anger, all this misery, it's real, but it's not going to get solved by an act of violence. It's going to get solved by an act of love. And that's where I kind of went with it. And I'm glad I did.
That's really interesting. And you mentioned this earlier, and I saw this film, I guess back when it was screening for Berlin. So it's been a while. And at the time there wasn't a lot, there was no trailer or anything. I didn't know what, I just knew this is, you know, Tim Sutton. So I'm going to watch mm-hmm. it. And when the trailer came out, in the synopsis, it says that that Saul's a makeshift superhero with a rage disorder. Okay. Yeah. And that was the first time I heard this in terms of a superhero story. And then you mentioned it earlier. Yeah. Is this, obviously there's no Marvel Studios vibes to this movie.
No,
really,
but it's
all
a superhero movie.
Okay. That's what I was going to ask. Is this Tim Sutton's superhero movie?
This is an origin story. And it started out originally as an origin story about Funny Face, the wild adventures of Funny Face and Burka Girl. It was about two caped Avengers who who are exploring New York City and try and take revenge on evil and try and stop evil. I'm saddened by, I like some Marvel movies. I despise many, and the DC universe as well. I think they're just, they've stolen the superhero away from the rest of us. The superhero is now just Robert Downey Jr. or Benedict Cumberbatch, or like, and hundreds of millions of, if not billions of dollars. You know, the superheroes started out as kind of a Brooklyn punk or a Queens nerd, and it was DIY stuff. And so I wanted to kind of reclaim the superhero story for the bodega group, you know what I mean? To make a punk rock kind of howling version of a superhero who can't really get things done, who doesn't have superpowers. He only has himself and his burrow. But I was really hearkening back to the, you know, the first times I read, you know, the Peter Parker origin story, or those origin stories that, you know, I grew up, you know, loving. And I felt like they've just been whitewashed. They've just been glossed over, and they're the property of the rich and powerful now. And so I wanted to again, go to war on that.
That said, since this is your idea of a superhero movie, and you don't really enjoy the big corporations in doing the superhero movies, do you ever see yourself doing like a full on, you know, capes and cowls sort of superhero movie?
Yeah, if I could do something the way I wanted to, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, listen, I do work for hire. Like, let's be honest, yeah. It's a business. And I love all kinds of movies, big and small, you know? So I have interest in doing all different kinds of movies, but I'm interested in building a body of work that has soul, most importantly. And all my movies, no matter if they're good or bad or reviewed or poorly or reviewed well, they have a soul, and they have a unique soul that you will put them back in the, you know, you'll watch them 30 years from now, and they will feel unique, and they will feel of themselves. They are not disposable. So if that's a superhero movie, great. This fall, I made a Western. I had no intention of making a Western. It was a gig for hire, but I made a Tim Sutton Western, and whatever that turns out to be, it's like, it's certainly an interesting twist on the genre. So yes, to answer your question, I'm game for it. It has to be me at the same time.
So one of those factors in kind of contributing the soul to the movies is one of the more fascinating things about your films is your casting. Like, you often pick actors that are a bit under the radar,
sure,
or they're on the verge, like with Donnybrook, obviously Margaret Qualley, Frank Grillo, and Funny Face, Cosmo, Jarvis. He's pretty amazing, and he brings a lot to the movie, the soul you were talking about. But you know that brings us to the next feature you have. Is that the Western, The Last Sun? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, The Last Sun. Well, The Last Sun's interesting because it has Sam Worthington, but you can't even see, yeah, you can't even tell it's him. He's completely unrecognizable. Like, right, 20 minutes into the movie, you'll be like, I think that's Sam Worthington. Which is, well, awesome. And was something that he had been planning for months, and he and I both planned. And then there's Machine Gun Kelly, who's in it, who's
that's the question.
Super there, famous, yeah. But nobody's, you know, he hasn't been in a good movie yet, as far as I'm concerned. And he hasn't played a role that takes you somewhere, as far as I'm concerned. And he really does this time. So, if I could work with Jude Law, I'd work with Jude Law. You know, I mean, it'd be great. But you have access to certain things. The first three movies I made had no actors in them. Why? Because I refuse to work with mediocre actors. I'd rather take real people and kind of, you know, work with them to make kind of legendary versions of themselves, right? So when Cosmo, I was introduced to Cosmo through Danny Streisand at UTA. And at first I was like, I don't know. I talked to him. He really understood the character, but most of all, the work that the guy puts in is like Daniel Day-Lewis shit. It's like he came to New York months ahead of time. He lived out in Brooklyn. He worked on his accent. He never broke character for the months that he was here until I yelled rap. I swear to God.
Wow.
Crew members were in tears afterwards because they had had this really close relationship with a guy named Saul. And then Saul disappeared right before their eyes. He really, really goes for it. And I had never worked with anyone quite like that. I mean, Jamie Bell is as close as I've gotten. Margaret Qualley's incredible. Frank Grillo, they're all great. But Cosmo really, really believed in this in this loser. And you don't get a lot of actors these days who play losers. You know, they're all trying to play something heroic or like Michael B. Jordan type stuff. And Saul and Cosmo, they're not hipsters. They're not cool. They're guys that have been kind of left behind, and they're kind of trying to claw back. And I think that takes a lot of work, and it takes a lot of dedication, and takes a ton of talent. And I was, you know, I think Cosmo's just, if he can get the right parts, he can do it all.
Yeah. And as far as, well, he is phenomenal. And then as far as, you know, the next one, Machine Gun Kelly, who I know is a musician, why did you choose him? Like you said,
I inherited that movie, actually.
So, really?
Yeah, I got a call from my manager in the middle of COVID and was like, do you want to make a Western? I was like, yeah, sure, why not? So I didn't cast that movie. But I think what I did do is that the producer's like, okay, he's got to dye his hair a regular color, or he's got to do this, he's got to do that. I was like, no, just let him be Machine Gun Kelly. Let him be himself. You know, the character is named Cal, and he's this punk. He's basically a punk rock cowboy. He's like a psycho cowboy. Let him be. Don't take a wild animal and put him in a wig. You know what I mean? Like, let him be a wild animal. And Coulson is a wild animal. And he also wants to learn. Like, he wants to be a great actor. So he listened to when Sam was advising him, you know, because Sam's been through it. You know, he's made multiple movies with James Cameron, for Christ's sakes. And, you know, when we talked about the idea of what acting truly is, it's about being yourself. It's about using your own history. And so a trust got built up, and I think he's fantastic in it. And I think he's going to be fantastic in other movies. And we're actually developing something together right now. So,
ooh, yeah. Little tease there.
I do have to ask, did a lot of your budget go to covering his tattoos, or are you letting him wear the tattoos?
The hair and makeup department had a fucking chore with that guy. But we, since it was period, our costume designer, Yvonne Reddy, who was fantastic, she designed stuff. So he was always, you know, kind of wrist to neck kind of thing. Yeah. And again, like with his hair, it's like he showed up with that hair and I was like, let him be bleach blonde, let it be weird, let him be punk rock. Because I think sometimes when period pieces come and they're all like yonder, and you know, they speak in that kind of vernacular, I buy it less than when they come in and say, hey, chill out. So I let him be him, and I love, you know, I had to fight the producers a little bit on it, but I think it works, and it's interesting, and it's natural, because that's what he's capable of doing right now. He's not capable of being Daniel Day-Lewis. He's capable of being Machine Gun Kelly.
That's really interesting. So recently we spoke to Frank Grillo, and I mentioned, of course, my love of Donnybrook, and he was like, you know, talking about how much fun he had with you, how he loves the movie and all of that. But he also mentioned that you were affected by some of the negative reviews. Ugh. And that obviously, no film is perfect, and even the best films have detractors, and we know that the people that didn't like Donnybrook are objectively wrong, but I'd love to know what your thoughts are on film criticism when it comes to features like yours, because as you said, this is movies that you make, you don't try to make four quadrant cookie cutter movies. You push the limits. You like to be divisive essentially. So when it comes to criticism, that doesn't always work. So what do you think?
It doesn't. It's a bummer, man, because, you know, I love film criticism. I mean, that's how I got into filmmaking. I was going to be like, you know, follow the path of like Godard and Bresson and Truffaut and like be a critic and then become a filmmaker. I mean, I went right to the filmmaking, but I read Sight and Sound religiously. I read, you know, IndieWire religiously. I read The Times religiously. And I got sucker punched a little bit because my first film and Pavilion and Memphis got really good reviews. I mean, other than some people saying it's like watching paint dry, which is, you know, a fair criticism. But with Donnybrook, I thought they did something really irresponsible. The negative criticism. You can criticize the film, but there were critiques that were like, criticize the title sequence, that criticized the cover of the novel, that criticized shots that were about like moments of near suicide that we worked very hard to create this emotional void. And they tossed it off like it was just, oh, it was too dark, it's not classy, blah, 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 you know, that kind of thing. And it killed the film. The film premiered opening night in Toronto for the platform competition. It won Fantastic Fest, and then it went away. And I, that's because I think critics didn't understand it and wanted to kind of destroy it. And so, yeah, it hurt. And of course, it hurt because, listen, I can take it, but like people didn't get to see it. You know what I mean? Yeah, and yeah. And you make a movie for an audience to make up their own, make their own decision. Donnybrook is not a movie about the radical right, the alt-right. It's not a movie about hate. It's a movie about survival. And it was, it shocked me that it took such a beating. Yeah, I mean, it really, it's a shame because it made me think like, oh, did I make a bad movie? Did I make a bad movie? Because It's hard. I mean, this is going to sound corny as hell, but it's hard to be an artist, you know? And so when you are an artist, you put yourself out there and you're expecting pros and cons, but when the pros are, you know, are really strong, but the cons kind of, you know, make them all disappear. It's a shock. And it makes you question filmmaking in general, not just film criticism.
Yeah. So I recently spoke with Eddie Wong this week, actually, and he has his first ever movie, Boogie. And he was telling me that that movie is like basically about his life. Like he pulled like from abuse and stuff, like some heavy, heavy shit. And the reviews are negative. And he said it like hit him hard. And he just was like, screw reviews. I'm just not reading them anymore. Right. Have you gotten to that point yet? Or do you still read them? Or are you just kind of like, you know, I can't let this get to me?
I still read them, but now I kind of have hardened myself to them. I mean, I actually kind of like have fun reading the non-critic reviews, just the people who review your stuff on Amazon Prime. And it's just like stupid movie. I kind of like, I don't like it, but it makes me kind of laugh. That's part of the game. But I do think like there are certain critics I won't read now because I've been scarred for sure. But I believe in film criticism in that, you know, when I was reading about my friend Eliza Hittman's film, like the critics got that one right. You know what I mean? And other films like Judas and the Black Messiah. I'm just thinking off the top of my head, these latest films. I think they got it right. And I learned about the filmmaking and that's and kind of relationship between the film and the world. And I think criticism matters. I just got to wear kind of a plastic suit when I like Christian Bale in American Psycho before.
Lightening things up a little bit here. So a few years ago, you were kind enough to do one of our movies that changed my life features. And there were a couple shout outs to the Brad Pack and films like St. Elmo's Fire and 16 Candles.
Yeah, man.
Probably the two best movies ever made. And you admitted that these are films that people probably would be shocked to know that you adore. So kind of in the spirit of that, and considering your films often deal with super heavy, dark situations and themes, care to share a few other Tim Sutton approved?
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
That would surprise you.
I think my wife and my favorite movie together is Silver Linings Playbook.
Oh, wow.
That is a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. David O. Russell is a master filmmaker. J-Law will never be better. Bradley Cooper the same way. Robert De Niro playing this authentic father and sports fan. I thought it was both beautiful. It's a romantic comedy that in someone else's hands could have been totally generic, but in this way it was emotional and beautiful and funny and had a sense of authenticity and fun. I can watch that movie endlessly.
Yeah.
As far, you know, I just watched The Crown and really liked it.
I think really everybody's obsessed with The Crown right now.
Yeah,
I know, it's hard not to be.
So are there any kind of continuing in that same area, like are there any more recent films that you're obsessed with or anything like that?
Not a lot of good movies.
Oh,
that I've seen like recently. Listen, you know, Eliza's film is really great. I like, Oh, I like, there's the movie, there's a movie on Mubi that's Beginnings yeah. by Russian filmmaker that I think is you know, totally ripping off Tarkovsky, but like, hey man, go for it. It's like totally enjoyable and totally mesmerizing, and I really like that.
Talk about another movie that did well at festivals and kind of just disappeared for whatever reason. But I mean, it's not an easy movie, obviously.
There's an 8-minute shot of someone sleeping in the woods. I mean, it's like they kind of go for it. But I think she's has incredible talent and will obviously make great movies. You know, you get bombarded with kind of the Oscar world, and I think some of those movies are just atrocious and unwatchable.
We won't ask you to name names. That's fine. Like that's, yeah,
that's good. But Beginning was really kind of blew me away as far as a recent movie goes. Awesome. And of course, Eliza's movie, I think, should have been nominated for an Oscar.
Never, rarely, sometimes, always, for those that don't know what he's talking about.
Yeah. And then as far as your upcoming slate, there was a couple of years ago, it was announced you were doing the Tobias Wolff adaptation of The Chain.
Yeah.
With Margaret Qualley and Jamie Bell and Sebastian Stan. Is that still something on the slate? It sounded pretty brutal.
It's still there. It is not first up on the slate, but it is still in development. I've written three drafts. That's with David Lancaster, who did Donnybrook. And it's just, I'll be honest, like, it got financed, but it didn't get financed at a level that would have made everyone very comfortable. Mm-hmm. And so that was a lesson for me. It's like, oh, we got multiple offers. Let's make the movie. But it's not always that clear because, you know, there's lots of fees involved. So that was disappointing, but I think it'll still happen. And again, like, I'm very proud of the script. I love Tobias Wolff. I was carrying that short story around in my back pocket since I was a teenager. I love David, and obviously I love Jamie and Margaret. And so hopefully we can do it.
You're finishing up Last Son. Anything else in the works? Anything else you have in the works that you're particularly excited about?
Yeah, man. I got two things in the works that I really dig. One is with Topic Studios called Bird's Point, which is that is a script by Bill Gullo, who's a great writer, who's right here in Brooklyn with me, and produced by Annie Martyr and Jordan Horowitz. That should be really interesting. It's about an engineer who goes back and has to flood his hometown and reconcile with a son that he abandoned long ago. It's kind of like a Americana drama. And I just finished writing this thing called Good News, which is...
I saw you posted something about that on Instagram.
Yeah, it's about the untimely overdose of a musician.
Oh, wow.
And so I will leave it unspoken who that musician might be.
Interesting.
Okay. Oh,
that's a tease. Both my co-hosts are big into music and play instruments. So I'm sure the possibilities are running through their heads. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's, listen, I get a lot of inspiration from Gus Van Sant. That's no lie. And it's not Last Days, but it seems like no one has made a hip hop tragedy yet. Mm. And I think there's a lot of tragedy. There's with the opioids and with people dying young and a lot of these SoundCloud rappers just not being able to reach their full potential because of society and because of Instagram and social media and drugs and all that stuff. So no one has made that movie yet. So I'm hoping to do so.
That would be fantastic. I tell you what, I don't really follow SoundCloud all that much. I'm a little old for that. But I'll tell you, like, seeing these guys die at like 20, 21, it's heartbreaking.
It's crazy. I mean, it's also interesting because my son, who's 15 years old, introduced me to the actual, I mean, it's loosely based on Mac Miller, on Lil Peep, on Juice WRLD. Yeah. And I didn't know any of Mac Miller's stuff. And my son introduced him to me. And I mean, it's just tragic. It's really beautiful and tragic. So
yeah,
we'll see where that goes.
Of course, we're looking forward to it for sure. So I want to get a wrap up here. So I want to thank Tim Sutton again for joining the Playlist Podcast, talking about Funny Face. It's been fantastic talking with you about this stuff.
Yeah, man. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. And so thanks, everyone, go check out Funny Face. It hits April 2nd. And if you haven't, and I can't say this enough, go find Donnybrook. I think it's like on IFC Films streaming right now, but you can buy it anywhere. So do it.